and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews donors, thought leaders, and professionals in the field of fundraising.
Hey, I hope everyone's having a great week and ready to start a new work week this Monday morning. This week, I get the opportunity to talk with Stephanie Cook about her career journey and most recent experiences with the National Audubon Society. We talk about how her broad higher education experience prepared her to work in a more niche area with a non-natural constituency base. So let's learn more about Stephanie. Stephanie Cook brings over 20 years of experience to her work as a fundraising executive for the National Audubon Society, leading operations, donor services, and fundraising teams on behalf of the International Conservation NGO. Prior to joining Audubon, she led NYC-based regional advancement teams for Syracuse University and Villanova University, where she led teams of development professionals charged with building relationships with and securing philanthropic support from alumni, parents, and friends. Her early career included service as a major gift officer for Columbia University and the Wildlife Conservation Society, as well as in support of the fundraising efforts on behalf of the Central Park Conservancy. She is a native of Madison, Wisconsin, and holds a BFA from the University of Kentucky in acting and theater, and an MS from Columbia University in fundraising and nonprofit management. Let's get started. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the Debrief.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
Where are you talking to us from?
I am at my dining room table in East Harlem, watching the cars fly up Madison Avenue, home for the afternoon, doing some work and follow up at the end of a long week.
It's so great to meet you. I think you're one of those development colleagues in this orbit that we've been in similar spaces at different times and known similar people. And we finally got connected just a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. I love the small world that is this business. And in particular, when you pick a niche, you end up in an even smaller world. So it's really fun. It's been fun to hear some past colleagues on your show. And I really enjoy that.
And shout out to Meg George and Roberta Albert.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Two gems and wonderful people in the field who I like to think of both as colleagues and friends.
Definitely. Definitely. So this is a fun conversation. We're going to talk sort of broadly about your experience and how you've taken it to different organizations. And if people have been listening for a while, they know I love talking to someone who has been in different sectors within the field, or I could say different fields within the sector. But you know, you've experienced higher ed, you're at a nonprofit organization now. And I think it's so great that you're able to share the skills back and forth. So I'll start with asking about how your experience in higher ed prepared you to working at the Audubon, which is totally different or somewhat similar. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, great question. So I think it's interesting because working in higher ed, you know, you're in this environment where you have a really natural constituency, right? You're working with alumni who have this affinity to the school. We used to joke, we were staff, we were probably going to come and go, but alumni would be alumni for their entire lives. And so there's this transient nature to the fundraising side of things, but not necessarily to the donor constituency in the same way that you sometimes see in the nonprofit world. So in that regard, coming to Audubon was a huge culture shift for me, right? Because I went from this natural constituency to really an open constituency. Anyone could potentially be a donor, right? Obviously, they need to have capacity and inclination, but you know, I could bump into somebody along the street one day and they might, you know, express some interest in birds or in the environment. And all of a sudden you strike up a conversation and, you know, you meet, you know, make plans to meet again. And you have a potential new major gift prospect on your hand, which I think creates a different universe for the work than you find in higher ed. And it can be really fun. It can also be really challenging, right? You don't have that kind of natural place to start. And so that was really big, a really big change for me. I mean, very, very early in my career, I did work at the Central Park Conservancy and the Wildlife Conservation Society. So I had a little taste of that, you know, open network kind of environment, but I was really young. I was just figuring out what I wanted to do with life. So I don't know that it necessarily settled in for me in the way that it did when I got to Audubon. On the flip side, the way our organization is structured could be mirrored exactly like a university. We've got a big national organization that's working across the entire hemisphere. We have state, regional, and country offices, which I like to think of as the schools and colleges. And we have nature centers all over the country, which, you know, you could think of as departments or other parts of the university environment. And so because of that structure, I was able to come in and kind of navigate, you know, am I talking to this donor about something that's kind of enterprise level? Or am I talking to them about, you know, this place that they really care about in this nature center that's in their backyard or this state that they live in? You know, obviously the birds don't know where the state lines are, but our donors do, and their natural affinity to these places that they care about because they live there, they experience the wildlife in their environment, I think is an important element in determining how they want to support the organization. But having had some experience in higher ed where, you know, you talk to a business school alum who also loves athletics or who's on the board of trustees, so sees that enterprise level need, you really get, you know, you can start to understand how those two environments really intersect and have a lot of similarities.
So you were able to bring in that context, that greater context and 360 view for a complex organization.
Absolutely. I also went from when I was at Columbia working within a school at the School of the Arts with Roberta, and then transitioned to my time at both Villanova and at Syracuse, where I was working for the entire university, but in a geographic location. And so I had that kind of big picture enterprise level fundraising experience and the experience of being embedded within something. And so again, I was able to leverage that experience to kind of navigate conversations with donors who, you know, had affinity to a state or a regional program or a nature center, and that we wanted to help engage and kind of elevate sites or awareness of the fact that, you know, those birds that come to your nature center are then going to fly down to Central and South America for the winter. And so everything that we do here in Center City, Philadelphia at the Discovery Center is going to be really important for that bird's life, but so too is our work in the Bahamas, where, you know, these birds might go during their migratory journey. And so helping to tell that story and use place to create that attachment for a funder, but then help them see, oh, wait, there's so much more that can be done hemispherically to help protect birds that they might want to plug into something different and elevate their giving in some cases to a more, you know, hemispheric or organization-wide scope.
So they're not all necessarily giving locally within their own, literally their own communities and habitats. Sometimes they could be supporting things in other parts of the world.
Absolutely. It's really actually very interesting. You know, the folks who have that deep place-based commitment, you know, can sometimes be really, really, you know, stuck in and connected, and taking advantage of some of the technologies that we've created as an organization in partnership with our friends at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and other organizations like our, you know, Migratory Bird Explorer, where you can go online and watch that bird that's in your backyard and where it goes throughout its life cycle. You know, we can help take that local important place to a donor and expand it and take them on a journey with us to all of the places that we do.
That's a great point, thinking about the juxtaposition of an alum who's giving to their college or their reunion with that nostalgic loyalty versus a funder who has sophisticated tastes and is interested in neuroscience and all these other things, that you can either be doing both or, of course, be meeting both where they are. So when we have the loyal donors who have been part of our organizations for a long time, they have that built-in love of the organization. How are you converting challenging donors who maybe don't have that into loyal volunteers? Because I think a lot of our listeners who are working in nonprofits and building up non-natural constituencies would love to hear how you've done that.
I mean, I think the first thing is listening, right? We in this business, we all know that our relationships are only as strong as our, you know, connection to the funders that we're working with. And so, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to understand what it is that really truly motivates that donor. And often with individual funders, you know, in across the industry, right, whether it's healthcare or in higher ed or, you know, kind of a traditional NGO, you know, there's usually a catalytic event in their life that brings them in contact with that organization, whether it's that they went to school there or that that organization cared for an important family member to them when they were in need, you know, as the case is with healthcare, or, you know, with an organization like Audubon, you know, maybe it's that their kids went to summer camp at one of our nature centers, mm-hmm. or they had an experience with a, you know, bird that hit the window of their home and they didn't know what to do. And they intersect with the organization because they know that they can take that bird to the Sharon Audubon Center. And that's a very tiny moment in their life, but it might open their eyes to something that changes their perception of an institution in mm-hmm. that moment. And so for us, we spend a lot of time asking ourselves the question, who should be supporting Audubon? Who isn't? Right? Because it's
yes.
you know, there's a lot of people out there that care about the environment. Not, unfortunately, as many that seem to be philanthropically involved in some of the other sectors in our business. We're only like 3.5-4% of the total goal for animals and the environment, which, you know, I'd love to see more of. But the reality is, you know, there's a lot of competing priorities in people's lives. And this is, you know, we're in one of those spaces that's not at the very top of the pile. But all of that said, we're still getting billions of dollars a year to support the work across the entire kind of animal welfare and environmental sector. So can't complain that much. But, you know, we do ask ourselves that question a lot because you see the news, you hear about the, you know, Mackenzie Scott's and the Jeff Bezos gifts to the climate and Bloomberg's new initiatives. And you're like, you know, obviously those are three huge names. Wouldn't that be amazing if we could find that cohort of people and then figure out what about what we're doing might spark their interest? And a lot of that, you know, with individual donors comes from just engaging in a conversation and listening to their experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think what makes Audubon really special is that everybody has a story about birds. You, and they're the most encountered wildlife in anyone's lives, right? They're everywhere, whether it's the 400 pigeons that my son chases on the way to school every morning that have this one spot where someone dumps breadcrumbs, or it's an experience or a trip somewhere amazing with your, you know, grandparents when you were seven, where you saw your first flamingo. And so I think we have this special opportunity at Audubon to hear and learn about those stories and those experiences and that, you know, kind of spark bird moment for people that allows us to open the door maybe differently than some of our environmental peers, because birds have this magical power that's kind of cool.
And you can have the story without being an expert.
Absolutely. I am not a birder.
So it's very approachable in that way, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it is funny because I run aground sometimes with the funders at Audubon who are real, true, kind of committed birders, because I'm just, that's not me. Mm-hmm. You know, I came to Audubon as a professional fundraiser and I'm in a professional fundraising job, which is great because that's what I contribute. I love birds. I think they're fascinating, but I cannot, with my binoculars, stare at a tiny warbler on the top of a tree in Central Park and tell you what kind it is. I can tell you maybe that it's a warbler. And there's like two warblers I think I can identify at this point after my 6 years at Audubon. But what I can do is listen and learn about other people's experiences and then think about what we're doing that might excite them and introduce and connect them to that. And that to me is how you take someone who doesn't have a relationship with the organization, or who, I don't know if challenging is the right word, but like that you don't necessarily have a natural in with, and connect them to the institution you're with. And I could see that working across sectors. You know, we have birds. I'm sure there are other ways to connect.
So you talked about a couple of different ways that people might come across your organization. What do you think the biggest pipelines are? Is it, especially at the major gift level, like, is it word of mouth? Is it your event strategy? Do you have data that tells you that answer, at least your gut instinct?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of ways. You know, we divide our thinking into three categories, right? Top down, and that's what we were just talking about, that like who should be supporting Audubon that isn't. Yes. You know, who are those billionaires out there who are funding, you know, climate change work or habitat protection? How do we get them in? And then we talk about inside out, right? We have about 500 advisory board members that work across the country in association with our nature centers and our state and regional offices who, you know, again, to go back to that higher ed model, are kind of like dean's advisory councils, right? If you think about that kind of framework. My higher ed days. So it's a group of people who are either already donors or who care about the work, who have expertise. You know, we actually have a Yale climate scientist on our board in Connecticut, which is awesome. And he's brilliant. And so they have this expertise and they bring that to the table and they partner with our conservation leaders to think about, you know, how are we doing this work? How are we impacting this landscape? How are we helping birds in this place? Which, you know, as we like to say, helps people too, because we are, you know, intrinsically related in that we all use the same habitat. And so they are a great resource for peer influencer, validator, partner in identifying or engaging with people that we identify as being potential prospects. And so that's that model. And then there's the bottom up, right? We've got a really strong direct response program. The person who runs that program's been with us for about 8 years. He's more than doubled our, basically back 8-9 years ago, we were just a magazine subscription, essentially. And he turned that subscription program into a direct response member resourcing program. And, you know, more than doubled the membership. We're trying to do that again over the next 5 years. And so there's a lot of opportunity in that community of supporters, as well as the people who walk in the door at our centers. And so we have our front porch, right? We used to say athletics is the front porch for higher ed. Our front porch is our nature centers, right? People come to walk the trails. They come to go send their kids to summer camp. They come to events and programs. They come to meet conservationists and hear their stories. So we're leveraging that. And I would say that probably our best asset for major gift pipeline building are those nature centers. The challenge is that they're not all in areas where there's a high capacity community adjacent, but for those that are, we have a really strong, pipeline. And I think our strategy at the organization to kind of move away from this idea of, you know, just your local place, but what does your local place do and fit into this larger kind of framework of a bird's life cycle or, you know, education for about the environment on a grander scale. How do we take that narrative and expand it in the minds of the people who do walk in those doors so they understand that the work that we're doing in Greenwich, Connecticut is just as important as the work we're doing in Center City, Philadelphia, or outside of Phoenix at our center at Rio Salado. So it's, you know, because not every center is, you know, in Greenwich. And we want to make sure that all of these places that become a resource for young people, and in many cases, young people who don't have any other opportunities to engage with nature, which is critically important, we want to make sure that they're all resourced successfully. And so we want to take our funders on that journey of, you know, this is your place. There's 35 others. And they're doing similar work and they're impacting these other communities. And can we tell you about how that's working and why that's important? And can we take you on this journey with us? And do you want to be a part of it? And so then we end up with funders who care about one place, who care about multiple places, who want to support the whole kind of enterprise level concept of, you know, this particular body of work.
So take us on the journey. I love that metaphor. Someone walks into one of your quote unquote back porches, you've somehow identified them and they're on a list. What are the steps that happen to get someone to being involved and committed?
Much like in major gift fundraising in any organization, you know, you want to make sure that they're connecting to hopefully a fundraiser or another member of the organization who understands and is embedded in the culture of philanthropy so that they can ask those questions and learn more about that person. What's their story? How did they end up here? You know, ask some of those probing questions that we ask to help understand capacity, understand inclination, and go through that journey with them. We have a kind of mid-level membership program that we call the Canopy, which is kind of the entree into being a major gift supporter to the organization. And we want to invite people to join the Canopy and be a part. Those folks Great get name. To travel with us. Oh yeah, right, the Canopy. It went through many iterations, I will say, before we finally settled on the Canopy, but we're all very happy with it. So we use that as a kind of litmus test, right? You know, if someone mm-hmm. can make a $10,000 gift to the organization with, you know, relatively minimal engagement, you know, they've met with us a couple of times, they've spent a year, they've been to an event or two, they've been to the center, you know, that's a good indicator for us that they're, you know, they want to be a part of the organization. They've raised their hand. They've said we're committed just because that's a meaningful number, right? Huh. And you know, that helps us kind of understand, is this person, you know, part of our membership community, or are they going to be a potential major donor? And from there, the Canopy program lets us take people on trips because we run, you know, 6 or 7 different experiences throughout the year where people go get to see the sandhill cranes in their migration through the Platte River in Nebraska every spring, which is an amazing Wow. experience. It's on scale with the wildebeest migration in the Serengeti. Like it is that hundreds of thousands of cranes
Wow.
in the river that like lift off at the same time in the morning as the sun rises. It's stunning. It's freezing. It's like 30 degrees out and you're in a cardboard box it's plywood box watching it happen, but it is really cool. So we take people on journeys like that. And so then we have this opportunity to introduce them to leaders and other professionals within the organization and bring them closer and learn more about them and what inspires them and why they care about the environment. And I think what's, again, neat about Audubon is we have birds, right, which is a great way to enter into the organization. But our work is really through the lens of birds. And it's really about protecting the places that birds need. And so we do a lot of habitat restoration. We have, you know, we have a huge policy operation that's thinking about the laws. You know, when the previous administration tried to roll back the Migratory Bird Treaties Act, which was a 100-year-old law. And actually, one of the reasons that Audubon was founded originally was in the creation of that to stop people from using feathers and hats back in the early 1900s. You know, we flexed our muscle to help make sure that those laws stayed in place and are actually working on legislation that will kind of make them so that they're permanent and that another administration couldn't roll them back. So, you know, we do all of these things, which, you know, again, through the lens of birds, but not necessarily just for birds, right? They are going to benefit biodiversity in general. They're going to benefit people and they're going to help address climate change. Because we know that for birds, if our total global climate increases by 3 degrees Celsius over the next, you know, over time, we're going to see massive changes in where birds can survive and thrive. And we're going to see extinction of hundreds of species. You know, we like to talk about how, you know, if you've ever been to the Adirondacks, you've heard, you know, like that, you know,
yeah,
we won't hear loons in the Adirondacks anymore. 3 degrees.
So sad.
It's really sad. And so as we tell these stories and as we learn from people about why they've come to the organization, we can better understand what are the things that we're doing that we want to connect them to. And as they begin to understand, you know, what we're working on and how we're approaching that work, then and the outcomes that we want to achieve with the work that we're doing, you know, whether it's habitat protection or climate change mitigation, then they come to a point where they want to invest and they want to invest significantly.
And it's that big idea, that big problem that people want to get behind.
Yeah, I think at the principal gift level,
yeah,
we're dealing with folks who want to solve problems, who want to stop things like, you know, the rising temperature? And what are the things that we can do to do that? You know, how are we developing a renewables grid and the transmission of renewable energy? And what is our strategic differentiator as Audubon? Well, you know, the intersection of wind and solar and where birds are is really important. You know, if you build a wind farm in the wrong place, it can have tremendous impact on a population of birds. So we can bring our science and our understanding of where birds are and what they're doing to the table in that interesting space. And funders are really excited about that. I mean, renewables is a big, you know, topic of conversation right now. And being able to talk about something that we have a really special position and an understanding of, funders really respond to that. Because, you know, I mean, there's hundreds of organizations working to combat climate change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are plenty of places that resources can be deployed. But if we can talk about what makes our position unique and how we can have a really unique impact on that journey, you know, funders really respond to that.
Tell us about your budget model. How does it work?
It's in the process of being changed, which is really exciting. Historically, we were kind of similar to a lot of ways universities are set up. You know, the departments and the colleges have their kind of their operating budget, and they operate on their own P&L or profit and loss statement, and they have to balance. And that's how our model has existed for the last 12 or 13 years. And that was put in place by our previous CEO for very good reason. The organization was in a really tough spot. There's actually a really great Harvard business case on his transformation of Audubon. That's a fun read for anyone who's interested in nonprofit administration. And it's kind of, you know, it literally leads up to the point when we restructured the development office 6 years ago and centralized fundraising. So it's kind of this look back at all of these great things that we reformed and changed. And then now we're remodeling the development team and restructuring it to meet the needs of this organization going forward. But what we've discovered over the last few years is that that budget model has really inspired a scarcity mindset at the organization, which in my experience, and I'm sure in many fundraisers' experiences, can be a real inhibitor to raising big kind of enterprise level gifts. You know, if you're worried as a leader about your operation and your department having enough money, your comfort level in opening up your kind of, you know, donor Rolodex, right? Because conservation leaders in our case, or, you know, doctors or deans, whomever, who have built really important relationships with the funders of their programs, their comfort level with opening those conversations up to bigger, you know, broader, less restricted gifts is really inhibited when they're worried about making budget. Mm-hmm. And so we're in the process of evaluating, and we're, you know, our CFO is talking to a number of partner organizations about, well, what are the budget models that you've seen that have been successful? You know, whether it's a kind of cost center structure where, you know, everyone's given a guarantee and then, you know, everybody has to work to raise that money, but the goal is to raise unrestricted funds and then resource where people need, versus the kind of, you know, every tub has its own bottom, which is, you know, kind of sort of where we've been for the last, you know, decade and a half or so. So the restructuring and then the thinking around how we do this to support fundraising has been really fun because, you know, again, I've worked in a couple of different environments that have helped me better understand what are the ways that a budget model can be constructed to help reinforce good behavior and that culture of philanthropy mindset versus reinforce bad behavior, like, you know, hoarding donors and, you know, not wanting to talk about anything beyond what's right in front of you. So we're still early stages. You know, we're
it's
still
exciting though to be watching it and be part of it along the way.
Absolutely. I'm having a lot of fun and I have a partner on the finance side. We're really digging in and getting nerdy about how this could work and how we would structure things and what makes the most sense. And what is the model that's going to help us ultimately achieve the outcomes that we're striving to achieve in our current strategic plan? Because it doesn't really matter what the structure is if we don't meet our goals, we're gonna be in a really bad place. So
it's centralizing it, right?
Yeah. And that's a big part of it. And
that's been my experience, is when you help someone else and it's helping everyone, then everyone's incentivized to work together and all ties rise.
Yeah. I think that the all boats rise kind of mindset is so accurate. And when people feel like they're in an environment of abundance and no one's worried about, you know, where their next meal is going to come from, they can approach philanthropy in such a different way. And I think funders sense that.
I think right? so too.
They feel it. And then they become attached and they restrict their giving more so than they may have in the past because of the person that they care about. And it just, it's kind of like, it's reinforcing this, you know, not virtuous cycle. Mm-hmm. So 15 years ago, it made perfect sense. And it was exactly what the organization needs. And now 15 years later, and in particular, with the centralization of the development team that happened 6 years ago, this concept or this thinking is the logical next step. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the theory we have, you know, obviously we've got to put it into practice and prove it, but the theory we have is that it's going to allow us to raise more money.
Well, speaking of big change, how are you thinking about and beginning to use AI as a team?
Excellent question. I would say we're still in the thinking about it.
Okay. It's the million-dollar question, Stephanie.
Right? I mean, everybody is trying to figure this out. I think the thing that scares me, obviously, is that, you know, we have a lot of personal and private information at the organization. And so how do you use artificial intelligence to model and create patterns so that you can understand, like, what the future could be without creating some sort of risk of data breach, right? Which, you know, I think we're all facing and terrified about generally, right? You know, that risk of, you know, a data breach at your gift processing center or otherwise, you know, it's a real concern. So as I think about it, my hope is that we can approach AI in the same way that we approach all of our kind of science and technology tools at Audubon. You know, we've been on the front end of some things. And then we've been in collaboration with other organizations on other projects. And then we've seen great benefit from things that other institutions have created, right? You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the Merlin app, which was, it was like the summer of birds in the New York Times.
And oh yeah. I do remember that.
Yeah. So you can take your phone outside and it'll listen to birds for you and tell you what birds are around you. And it's a pretty fun thing. And, you know, tons of Audubonners are using that technology. It's not ours, but it's still amazing. So, you know, I mean, I know there's a lot of work being done on how to use AI as like a you know, fundraising assistant, right? The generation of outreach. I mean, I'm pretty sure that we're all getting, you know, generated cold calls in our inboxes from all manner of consultants and vendors who are pushing information out on the sales side. And I think that there's some models out there that are doing that on the fundraising side that are interesting to me. But the space that I want to dig into and unpack is how can it be used to help us understand and uncover new potential donors? And I don't know the answer to that right now. Because I don't know how to do something like that without giving it something to learn from. And I can't do that. I don't want to do that because the thing that it's going to learn from is not my thing to share. And so trying to understand the technology better. And I'm joining our, you know, kind of AI working group at Audubon to think about how AI can be used as an organization. I'm excited to dig in, but you know, the reality is, to me, machine learning's power is in helping us see patterns that we can't see. And to me, that's how you prospect, right? Yeah. I think prospecting is just pattern identification. And so that's my big question, is how can I do this in a way that is safe and respectful and, you know, following our code of ethics, while also leveraging technology to help us raise more money. So more to come on that.
Well, the fact that you have a working group says a lot, though, that you're starting to have those conversations. And I appreciate even you sharing the concerns is interesting to hear and interesting to think about.
Yeah. These are interesting times we're living in, Catherine.
So I have two signature questions today. One is a little bit more heady, generally speaking. What will change? What is changing? And what won't change? And I would ask that you don't think too much about each one. Like, what's at the top of your head?
It's funny because I'm like, climate. I mean, the climate is changing.
That's a good answer.
It will change. It is changing right now. And, you know, I mean, in a strange way, I hope that we can not have it change that much. In a strange way, it's kind of the answer to all three.
Yeah. Well, that's on theme for this episode.
It certainly is.
And lastly, what do you know for sure?
I listen to your show all the time. So of course I have been percolating on this one and yet you ask it and I'm like, oh gosh, what do I know for sure? Depends on the day. I think that what I know for sure is that nothing is static, right? Everything is always, I think, in flux. And even when you think things have settled and you're on the right path, you're heading in the right direction, you've got your strategy and your plan and you're just, full steam ahead, there's always going to be something that comes up that requires a left or a right turn. And I think that I like to approach life with that in the back of my mind, that it's okay, right? That I can make all the plans in the world, but sometimes they don't matter. And I think in fundraising in particular, owning that is so important because we do spend a lot of time in our heads thinking about our donor strategy and what the plan is. And then you walk into the meeting and, there's a different element in the conversation that you're not prepared for, or, if there's somebody that's participating that you weren't expecting, a partner or someone's in the house that you weren't there, thinking was going to be there, or you decide to go to a restaurant and you have a really attentive server who keeps interrupting you, best advice I ever got was never plan an ask meeting at a restaurant. And so being able to be, adaptable and resilient to that constant change, I think is really important. It's a cook household model with my little ducklings. So we always talk about being adaptable and resilient.
The whole time you were talking, I was thinking to myself, you must be a really good mother of four.
Well, I will say that I am a mother of four. I don't know if I'd give myself really good, but I try. And it is fun. And we talk about being adaptable and resilient a lot.
It's a good thing to learn early.
Yeah, exactly. We never tell them we're doing something until it's actually happening. Because otherwise you deal with the disappointment. So there's that, things are always changing, right? Best laid plans.
Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for giving us just a little bit more information about your amazing organization. And I'm definitely interested in learning more and reading more. And so thank you.
Well, thank you. And, sometime when you're on the coasts up there, you can check out all those beautiful shorebirds hanging out for the summer season and that head down south for the winter, because you're definitely in a good spot. And we've got a lot of really great things happening on the coastline in Connecticut. So
that's so great. Thank you, Stephanie. All right.
Thanks, Catherine. This was really fun.
Hey, listeners, it's Keith from Evertrue. Evertrue is the end-to-end solution for insight, outreach, and analytics for higher ed advancement and stewardship teams around the world. Recently, we launched Evertrue Studios, advancement's very first media hub, where subscribers have access to over 100 hours of free, on-demand original series and podcasts, all created with fundraisers in mind. We're thrilled to feature the Development Debrief on Evertrue Studios podcast network. Check us out at evertrue.com/studios.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you're new to The Debrief, I welcome you to reach out to me on LinkedIn or check out the website at www.devdebrief.com. I'm also active on Instagram at devdebrief, where you can hear a little bit more inside the episode and get other information from me and my day-to-day life and connect with other fellow listeners. So I'm looking forward to hearing from you, and I hope you have a great week.